Welcome to EI Talks, the podcast that takes ideas seriously. I'm Paul Lay, Senior Editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and today I'm joined by Charlie Lederman, Senior Lecturer in International History at King's College London, and the author of, along with Brendan Sims, Hitler's American Gamble, Pearl Harbor, and the German March to Global War. Welcome, Charlie.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you contend, Charlie, that the 96 hours following the attack on Pearl Harbor by the Japanese on the 7th of December 1941 is the most important moment in diplomatic history. And so the question I've got to ask you is, why?
Yes, well, there's a number of challenges for that. So, of course, it's a provocative statement to make. But I think the reason why I would say that this moment, these 96 hours, is as consequential as any crisis, certainly in 20th century diplomatic history, but possibly more broadly as well, is first and foremost, I'd say the obvious is that it transforms that war into an even more destructive and world-encompassing war than the First World War. So that this period of the beginning of December 1941. And if I broaden it out slightly and say that it's part of a week that really transforms every front of that war, when you think that the German forces are on the outskirts of Moscow by the beginning of 1941, that Japan and China are at war, but Japan is maintaining diplomatic relations with the other global powers who aren't aware of moves that the Japanese are making to expand their operations. The United States at that time is arming the Allied powers, in the British, the Soviets, and China through Lend-Lease. It's become this arsenal of democracy. It's engaged in an undeclared naval war in the Atlantic. But at the same time, the idea that it is inevitably moving to full-scale intervention in that conflict is by no means certain. So there's a lot up in the air. There's a lot up in the air in North Africa as well, in terms of the British and the German struggle there, the possibility that the Germans are going to launch this counterstrike through Libya to the Suez Canal, the battle in the desert is going back and forth. So this is a real hinge point in the conflict. And I think one of the things about it, and one of the reasons why I'd also emphasize its significance, is that I think for a long time, we thought we understood it very, very well. And a part of this is because the major actors, looking back on it, tended to project an air of inevitability about what happened. And the most important of those, of course, is Winston Churchill. Churchill would write in his memoirs of the Second World War that the moment that the Japanese strike Pearl Harbor, that he knows essentially the game is up for the Axis powers, that he goes to bed and sleeps the sleep of the saved and thankful, because we had won after all. The Americans were in the war up to the neck and into the death. So that was the sort of perception that Churchill projected. But actually, for all of that, it wasn't clear over those days that Churchill was certain of this. In the idea of American full-scale intervention, throughout this period, he had projected this sort of public bravado throughout this period that essentially, even prior to December 1941, that as he says in speeches on Lend-Lease, that if the US give us the weapons and we will finish the job. Well, actually, he knows that full-scale US direct intervention is necessary for the British to win the conflict. And he's by no means confident about this. He's writing to the Americans throughout the later part of 1941, even after the Atlantic Charter statement is put forward by the US and the British in the summer of 1941, which looks forward to a world after the Nazis are defeated. But at the same time, Churchill is saying to the Americans that there's waves of depression throughout the cabinet because they're not clear that American intervention is going to occur. His close advisor, Jan Christian Smuts, will talk about Roosevelt being Hamlet-like in his hesitation when American ships are being fired at on the high seas, but Roosevelt isn't moving towards a direct intervention and calling for a declaration of war. So there's so much up in the air on this period. And if I sort of give you sort of a snapshot of the significance, Churchill on the night of December the 7th, 1941, sitting with his head in his hands during dinner with American diplomats partly because of the fear that a Japanese strike will ultimately bring Britain into a war in the Pacific, as well as in the Atlantic and the Mediterranean. But it's by no means clear that if the Japanese avoid a strike on the United States as well, that the US will be brought into that conflict. So Churchill is in a very precarious position, and that's sort of the position that we sort of start the book with in December 7th, 1941.
Yeah, it's really quite striking to me when I read the book, is the contrast between Roosevelt's actions and those of Churchill, because Churchill strikes me as being almost in a state of panic in some way. We have, for example, this idea of offering Irish unity. He seems to be reacting immediately to these events, whereas Roosevelt seems to have a much calmer approach in preparing US opinion in the wake of Pearl Harbor. He has to counter these really quite strong isolationist sentiments that are there, whereas Churchill is sort of running around almost like a rabbit in headlights.
Yes, I think the sense, I think for a long time, as part of this idea of the significance of this, is there was an idea for a while that Roosevelt's calm comes from the fact that isolationism collapses overnight with the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. But I think when you slow the picture down, when you look at what occurs over those few days, it's certainly not the case that isolationism completely collapses with the Japanese attack. Roosevelt is in a very precarious political position. The idea that he can just preempt Adolf Hitler with a declaration of war on Germany as well is by no means certain. He's extremely concerned in terms of the political perspective, but he projects this image of being in control of the situation. I think that's constantly the case with Roosevelt. He doesn't really let his closest aides in, so they don't really see his sort of his inner turmoil during this period. But I think an insight into that is given when he speaks to his wife Eleanor on the afternoon of December 7th, 1941, after the Japanese attack has taken place. So there's an awareness that this sort of shocking, destructive attack has occurred, but it's not clear yet just how destructive it will be, or whether the whole Pacific Fleet has been able to avoid being caught up in this. And he says to Eleanor, he says, "We don't. I don't know what our response to this will have to be. We don't necessarily have enough navy to go round. How can we fight a war in the Pacific and in the Atlantic?" So, as you say, there's a sense that Roosevelt projects this image of calm, and there's a sense in the historiography and the way in which we look back on it that everything was inevitable moving from Pearl Harbor to America's entrance into the full-scale war. But actually, there's a lot that's up in the air, and I think the way in which Roosevelt handles that politically is striking and a fascinating sort of insight into political leadership in a time of crisis.
Yes, because he has to carry the American public, and I often think people don't realise just how strong the isolationist current was among Americans. I mean, and the case is made by, you quote, R. Douglas Stewart, the founder of America First, the great isolationist movement, who says, and I quote here, "The facts and arguments against intervention in Europe remain the same as they were before the Japanese issue arose," the Japanese issue being Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of where America First falls on this, I think it's very interesting. Like their statement, as you say, is essentially to support the war in the Pacific, but to hold fire on whether they will support a war in Europe as well. And actually, to a certain extent, Roosevelt's position is made more challenging. It's not just the pressure group of America First, it's a whole range of sort of leading non-interventionist senators, people like Burton Wheeler of Montana, yeah. Hiram Johnson, the California senator. They're basically saying to Roosevelt, "Don't you dare take advantage of this situation to sort of pull us into a war in Europe as well." And they are also saying to him, "We have been left in a more vulnerable position in Asia and in the Pacific, because you've been giving so much of our best material away to the Europeans, to the British, to the Soviets." Now, of course, Roosevelt's strategy throughout this period had been on the idea that Germany was the greater threat. This doesn't mean he takes his eyes off the ball with regard to Japan completely, he still sees the Japanese as a threat linked to the Germans, but the principal focus is the Germans, which is why this economic aid has been going on. But for Roosevelt, I think what's really important to bear in mind, which I think sometimes isn't quite considered as clearly with regard to this, is the importance of him very cautiously moving the American public forward on these sort of questions. And I think he, having been Assistant Secretary of Navy under Woodrow Wilson, always has the ghost of Woodrow Wilson sort of looming over him. He writes his speeches in the White House with a big picture of Wilson, a big portrait of Wilson sort of hanging on the wall above him. And for Roosevelt, the sense is the lesson from Wilson with the League of Nations debate had been that Wilson had got too far away ahead of the American public, and that leads to his downfall and essentially the destruction of his program. And Roosevelt is cautious and very concerned never to allow that to happen. And he thinks, if I'm going to bring the US again into an intervention in a war in Europe, I need to have complete public support behind me. So the fact that America First is maintaining this position, this potential sort of fly in the ointment, is a real concern to Roosevelt. So he's moving very cautiously during this period. And Lend-Lease is a major factor within all of this. And America First continues, and many elements of the American public continue to be up in the air about the question of an intervention in Europe as well. So if from about mid-November 1941, if you look at the opinion polls, as late as that, it's still the case that about as many Americans want to stay out of a direct intervention in Europe as to stay in, even if it meant that essentially the war goes against American interests with regard to the Allies in Europe. That's not to say that the majority of Americans don't want the Allies to win.
Yeah.
It's just that they don't necessarily think that a direct American intervention is necessary to do that, or really really desirable.
And perhaps we shouldn't also underestimate just the sheer shock of the attack. This is a nation in shock, because I don't think anyone thought this was going to happen. There's the famous quote of we are being attacked. This is not a drill. This sense of surprise that comes over, because the likelihood was, of course, if Japan did enter the war, it was going to be an attack on British and Dutch possessions in Southeast Asia, for example, as happened, of course, with Singapore ultimately, rather than an attack on the United States.
Yes, so that's absolutely the case. If you look at the sort of diplomatic negotiations in the period leading up to December 7th, 1941, the British are very concerned to ensure that they get the commitment from the Americans that if the Japanese just strike against the British, or against the British and the Dutch, then the Americans will also come into the conflict. And there's real back and forth about this. And Roosevelt is essentially saying to them, we'll be with you, but we need to get sort of the congressional support. And that is a big if in terms of the backing for. So it's not clear if the Japanese had taken that decision to just strike against the British, that Roosevelt would have been able to handle the politics to bring the Americans into a war to fight against the British, to fight for the British Empire. So that is the sort of way in which it would have been perceived and projected by his opponents. So there's a lot up in the air. I mean, by the what we're starting to see in the day or so before this is an awareness that the Japanese fleet is moving, that they are moving towards a potential strike. But the idea that they're going to strike on the other side of the Pacific at Pearl Harbor hasn't really entered into the minds of the sort of leading American policymakers. And there's a sense there in terms of the intelligence picture that this we tend to sort of think of the intelligence being far more sophisticated than it was during this period. At this time, the US is mainly getting sort of undigested sort of cables. It doesn't necessarily have the intelligence capacity to be able to analyze this in a way where actually the dots could be sort of put together in a way which obviously, when we look back, we can see where the Japanese are moving towards. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the other aspects of that that's really important to bear in mind is it also challenges the sort of long-standing revisionist argument that essentially Roosevelt was sort of maneuvering the Japanese to strike so he could bring the US into a war in Europe as well.
Yeah.
I think there's a number of problems with that scenario. One, as I mentioned previously, the idea that, that the destruction of the US Navy in the Pacific would allow the US to have enough Navy to go round, as Roosevelt says, to fight a war on in these two oceans. The US doesn't have this sort of infrastructure in place at that point. It's not clear that they are, it's to look back and sort of see the way in which the US industrial potential ramped up. And as I say, Roosevelt had been Assistant Secretary of the Navy. He had a deep love for the Navy. The idea that he'd be willing to sacrifice that is extremely problematic. Mm. As I say, also the political side of it, the idea that a war in the Pacific would inevitably lead to the US being able to get into a war in Europe when the American public are saying, actually, the focus should be on the war in the Pacific. And then the third aspect of that is the intelligence picture all round.
Yeah.
It's just not clear from the American perspective that the Germans will respond to a Japanese attack on the US by coming into the war as well. We have to remember that the tripartite pact between Germany, Japan and Italy committed each side to come to war if one of them was attacked, not if they were the aggressor. Yeah.
So there's no that Hitler's not treaty bound in any way to come to the aid of the Japanese.
Exactly. And the Japanese are, I mean, it's not just the Americans are concerned about this, but the Japanese are concerned about this as well. If you look at the discussions going on in Tokyo ahead of the strike, there's a sense, and Emperor Hirohito is putting this quite clearly through a number of his aides, the idea that the Germans might engage in what they call racial abandonment after the Japanese attack, that essentially the Germans will join together with the other Anglo-Saxon powers against the Japanese. This sense that, that anyone can predict the way in which Hitler will act is really sort of is something which again doesn't sort of capture the essence of the confusion of the period. And Robert Sherwood, the speechwriter for Franklin Roosevelt, has this great line where he says that sort of we knew through intelligence that there were these pledges that Hitler was making, but at the same time, how can you believe that Hitler would be sort of covered by these sort of bourgeois considerations of pledges and honor? This was someone who had shown himself to be extremely distrustful. And so for all sides of this, the sense of how Hitler will act once the Japanese decide to do this is really up in the air. And that's what makes that period after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor so fraught, but also so uncertain.
Mm. And can you give us a sense, Charlie, of the kind of diplomatic noise, the architecture that's taking place, you know, between the United States and Britain, between the Allies and the Soviet Union, of course, who are implicated in this. There's great concern, as you've already said, about the British situation in North Africa, for example, as well as the Soviet defence of Moscow, which is taking place at this point. So can you give us a sense of the back and forth of diplomatic missions in the immediate aftermath of Pearl Harbor?
Yes, absolutely. I think one of the things to bear in mind is the importance, even prior to December 1941, of the way that US Lend-Lease aid was really connecting all of these fronts together already, and the significance of Lend-Lease. And so for Churchill, this sense to which he goes to bed and sleeps the sleep of the safe and thankful, part of the reason that we know that wasn't the case is that he looks completely exhausted across these days. Almost anyone who sees him is aware that he's absolutely shattered. His main concern is to get to Washington as soon as possible to ensure, one, the sort of Germany first discussions that have been going on previously are maintained, with the US not even directly at war with Germany at that time, but also that the supplies that the US have been providing to the British, which have become so essential to the British war effort, would continue. And and what actually happens on the night of December the 7th, 1941, which I think is quite underexplored in the history of this, is that the US impose a full embargo on Lend-Lease aid going out to Europe at that time. So there's these dramatic scenes where ships at sea are being sort of turned around. There's in particular, there's material in harbour being sort of unloaded off of ships going to Europe, put onto ships to go to the Pacific, because of course the US's main focus at this time was the onslaught that the Japanese were leading not just on Pearl Harbor, but into East Asia, in Manila, and elsewhere in the Pacific. So their focus was on that. And the and Churchill's being woken up in the early hours of the morning to be told, not only are we not going to be getting our tanks and our planes, but many of the commodities and chemicals that we've come to rely on in order to build our own infrastructure and our own weapons is not necessarily forthcoming as well. So there's a real concern about this in London, real panic during this period. Churchill and his Minister of Supply, Lord Beaverbrook, really sort of challenged by this. But also the main concern, as you say, is for the Soviets as well. They have become extremely reliant on lend-lease suppliers at this point, even though I think most of the historiography suggests that it doesn't come till later. But actually, at this point, the British are providing a large number of tanks, Valentine tanks, which have been crucial in the defense of Moscow. I mean, by some calculations, about a quarter, fifth to a quarter of the Russian tanks outside of Moscow at this time are British-made Valentines. And as I say, this connection between these different fronts and the way in which the US is providing lend-lease aid to the British providing it to the Soviets, and then sort of this sort of circular relationship between them, and what the knock-on effect of an embargo might mean, that if the British need to start pulling back supplies of tanks and planes with the focus on other fronts, what that will mean for the Soviet Union as well in terms of its defense of Moscow. So a lot of these knock-on effects are leading to huge panic, and it's clear that the new Soviet ambassador to Washington, who actually arrives in Washington on the day of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, his main concern in all of his conversations with the Americans is we need to continue to receive this material, and the answers he receives are not necessarily reassuring at first.
Yeah, and there is this continued uncertainty. And so we come to what is really the key to your book, which is Hitler's response. We already have what is essentially an undeclared naval war between the US and Germany, but there is no official declaration of war so far. As we've said, Hitler is not in any way treaty bound to support Japan, but he does declare war on the United States, this ultimately catastrophic gamble which unites two separate conflicts into a global war. And whatever the timescale, it makes Hitler's defeat, the Axis defeat, inevitable because of the sheer economic and material power of the United States.
Yes, as you say, I think for a long time the perception was that Hitler's decision to declare war on the United States was almost an afterthought. It was a mistake, but it was one that sort of wasn't taken with much consideration. There was a sense of almost a disdain for the United States, both racially and the sense to which it couldn't really stick it in a war of this sort. But actually, most of the recent literature has started to show the importance for Hitler from a very early point of the United States, from his experience on the Western Front in the First World War, and particularly in the 1920s, where he looks out on the world, and in his second book, which he doesn't publish, puts a big emphasis on the industrial power of the United States. He's aware from a very early point that the United States as a power is potentially going to be unrivaled in its sort of economic and industrial potential. And his hope initially is to avoid the possibility of a war with Germany, with the United States. But really, from about 1937, when Roosevelt issues his famous quarantine speech, where he says essentially Germany, Japan, and Italy are these aggressor powers, Hitler had been sort of thinking of the US as this sort of have power with the Nazis and the Japanese and the Italians as have not powers, needing to sort of acquire resources and ensure essentially German hegemony over Europe in order to be able to compete with the United States. But really, from about 1937 onwards, there's a sense to which Roosevelt is not going to allow him to do this, and he sees the United States increasingly as a threat. And when you get the sort of cash and carry provisions, lend lease, undeclared naval war in the Atlantic. The Atlantic Charters that, as I said, looked forward to a world before the US is even in the war, where this is a world where the Nazis would essentially be defeated. This, from Hitler's perspective, is that the US has never really been neutral, that from his perspective, war is inevitable and he needs to move towards essentially preempting this. His experience on the Western Front in the First World War and the way in which the US had been able to choose the time to come into that conflict after the sort of declaration of unrestricted submarine warfare, Hitler has this line where he says, great powers don't allow war to be declared on them, they mm-hmm. declare it themselves.
Yeah.
So from Hitler's perspective, he needs to sort of set the timing on this. And so, let's say, from his perspective, there was a sense that this war was inevitable. And I think it's his decision, as you say, that is so critical within this, because for so many of the other actors at this time, so much is up in the air. But for him, from the moment the Japanese strike Pearl Harbor, for him, that is a moment of elation. And there's a desire immediately to get back to back west in order to issue his declaration of war and ensure, essentially, from his perspective, that the Japanese can pin down the US so that he can acquire enough resources, make this sort of blockade proof space in Europe. And that, as he sort of puts it to one aide, that it's often the case that you might have a big boxer fighting against a small boxer, but if the small boxer is able to essentially attack early and sort of keep the bigger boxer off guard, then essentially they can control the momentum of this. And that's sort of Hitler's perspective. He doesn't necessarily have a rationale in place for how he's going to defeat Nazi Germany and how he's going to defeat the United States. Mm-hmm. But what he does envisage, as you say, is a gamble in order to sort of gamble on time, short term over long term, in order to acquire the resources and create this blockade proof space that will allow essentially Nazi Germany to sort of to see off the United States' challenge and ultimately make them come to terms with him.
Now, with hindsight, it does seem inevitable, the defeat of the Axis forces. And I know, as a historian, as do you, Charlie, that we should never use the word inevitable. I wonder if there is a scenario that you could imagine, a realistic scenario, in which the Axis forces do not lose, whether there was any alternative other than their complete destruction once Pearl Harbor had taken place.
I think the possibility of the Axis powers being able to win out here, I think, is implausible, really. But I think one of the things that's important to bear in mind is the way in which things happen from a time frame perspective. And I think even the possibility for a bit more strategic patience, it's not really a term that we tend to associate with Adolf Hitler.
Indeed.
But if he'd been able to hold out for weeks or months, the confusion that was caused by Lend-Lease and the challenges that were put on the United States and on Roosevelt on how you essentially the Lend-Lease resources are sort of disseminated across the different fronts, that would have caused huge challenges for the Allied powers, that the possibility of what might have occurred with this embargo staying in place for longer is what might have happened in North Africa, what might have happened in terms of the situation in Moscow, so that the German situation would have been enhanced potentially by the possibility of this Lend-Lease embargo continuing. So I think that's one of the things that's sort of up in the air and what that might have sort of the knock-on effects in terms of the conflict, in terms of what it would have taken to recapture and reconquer those territories. It's got to be remembered that the victory program that the United States developed in the summer of 1941 talks about the possibility of the United States being able to sort of win the conflict, even if the British and the Soviets are knocked out of it. So
yeah,
there's no doubt about the industrial might and power of the United States. But this obviously is not much comfort to the to its allies if it had been in this position where the US was essentially putting most of its emphasis on the Pacific at that time.
Yep.
So I think, as you say, the possibility of the Axis being able to win this war is pretty implausible. But the way in which things occur in history are very important, and timing really matters.
Yeah. Well, you've made a very eloquent case, Charlie, for the importance, and it's plainly a hugely important moment in history, the events that took place on the 7th of December 1941 and their outcome. And you contend, as I've said before, that this is the most important moment in diplomatic history ever. I wonder if there are other contenders for a prime moment in diplomatic history. I've got particularly in mind the negotiations to end the First World War that were attempted by Woodrow Wilson in the winter of 1916 to 1917. This is before the United States entered the war. It's something that's been analysed by, among others, Philip Zelikow, who is a friend of Engelsberg ideas. I wonder if how we rank these ideas of important moments in diplomatic history.
Yes, and that's an excellent book by Philip on that. And I think Adam Tooze's book also takes that as a sort of starting point, The Deluge. And as you say, I think that is a fundamentally crucial moment, and the contingency of these moments is so critical. We tend to sort of to look back on what occurs in that period in the First World War and look at American intervention as inevitable. But the tensions that are being caused by the US and the British with obviously we've got the sort of declaration of unrestricted submarine warfare that the Germans would ultimately engage in, and there's sort of challenges on the high seas there. But I think, as those books show, we often tended to underestimate the challenges in US-UK relationship. We tend to sort of look back and think, well, the rapprochement between Britain and the US at the beginning of the 20th century made the US intervention on the British side inevitable. But actually, the British are in a position early in 1917 where they're close to running out of wheat. Wilson doesn't want to see the British lose the war, but he does want, in terms of those negotiations, a peace without victory. And it's ultimately, as you say, it's the German decision that lets the British off the hook in terms of that declaration of unrestricted submarine warfare in January 1917. So I think it is a very crucial moment. And obviously out of that comes US intervention, and really, as AJP Taylor has said, sort of the transformation of European geopolitics, where the US and the Soviets emerge out of 1917 as the dominant powers. And that is a direct result of this intervention that the Germans engage in. So I'm not going to deny just how important the winter of 1916-17 is in this question. As I mentioned previously, I think one of the things that's important for me in this is the way in which this sort of becomes an even more world-encompassing conflict, occurs in 1941, and an even more destructive conflict. So whether we rank things on that basis, I don't know. And I think it's a challenge to get into these discussions about what is more important. I think one of the things that I would like to stress is the importance of the knock-on effects in terms of the actors involved. So for many of those actors in 1941, they are thinking back on that moment in 1917. As I say, Roosevelt had been Assistant Secretary of the Navy. Hitler's life is transformed by this intervention. And so for him, the fact that the Germans allow the Americans to declare war on them is something which he ultimately thinks has been sort of psychologically devastating for Germany, and that he wants to avoid. So, as I say, these crises, they're interlinked, they're interconnected, and the memory of them sort of plays out. So I think that's probably a bit of a fudge in terms of your answering your very, very good question with regards to this. But I think both moments are sort of seismic shifts in the sort of the geopolitical position of both Europe and the world. But actually, I would say that 1941, because the conflict is just more world encompassing, there's probably more of a sort of a world encompassing sort of crisis that emerges out of this.
And both examples, and there are many, many more of crucial moments in diplomatic history, just show us how important that topic, diplomatic history, is. It's an absolutely crucial field, but it's one that I feel in recent years has been somewhat disparaged And yet there's still plainly a hunger for it. I mean, you're a modern historian, Charlie. My speciality is the early modern. I mean, we've seen Claire Jackson's book, Devil Land, which is an early modern diplomatic history of England's relations with Europe, become a great success, attain a readership. I find diplomatic history fascinating. Why do you think it has been disparaged? And do you feel optimistic about its purchase? I mean, its relevance could not be greater, I don't think. Now, I don't like to overdo the relevance issue when talking about history, but when we look at the situation in the Middle East, when we look at the situation in Ukraine, and we look beyond that, all kinds of crises, multiple crises around the world at the moment, diplomatic history is absolutely crucial, it seems to me.
Yes, you won't find me challenging the idea of the importance of diplomatic history. But as you said, I think for a long time it was disparaged. And I think the sense, Zahra Steiner, the great diplomatic historian, once said that the sort of the perception of diplomatic history was this idea that it was just what one sort of clerk or government agent says to another, and that what's the sort of impact on this more widely. And I think people like her and a whole range of sort of a generation of diplomatic historians have shown the significance of this. We've talked quite a bit about the nature of contingency, of uncertainty, mm-hmm. the importance of that, and the way in which multi-archival research can really recapture these moments and the significance of being able, when you look back, if we're just looking at things from one nation's perspective, you don't get the ability to be able to see how actions and decisions taken in one capital have these sort of knock-on effects elsewhere. And I think that to me is at the sort of heart of the significance of diplomatic history. But I think also, I think sometimes we tend to sort of judge all elements of history by things, by the as I say, this sort of what one clerk says to another with regard to diplomatic history. It's sort of in its sort of most banal form. But actually, all history really should be judged by sort of the best elements of it. And the best sort of studies of diplomatic history have these sort of ways in which they encompass both the sort of all other areas of history as well, and the experience of the wider generation, whether that's the military history, the social history, the political history. All these things have that knock-on effect with regard to diplomatic history, and the ability to move between the sort of the big picture and the micro, I think, is crucial in diplomatic history. It's not just what's being said between diplomats or mm-hmm. even between leaders. It's the way in which those decisions basically transform people's lives in really profound ways. And as you say, I think one of the things that's really important about this is the way in which it speaks to sort of echoes of contemporary challenges. And I think that's obviously that shouldn't be overdone when we're looking at analogies, the sense to which we need to be able to understand the similarities as well as the differences, the idea to which the past is a foreign country, they did things differently there, that famous quotation. Really, that obviously needs to be kept in mind. But there are obviously really, really important echoes. You mentioned this with sort of Claire Jackson and Devil Land, the sort of the relationship between England and Europe, the questions of sort of ideology and realpolitik. Those are sort of everlasting sort of dilemmas with regard to those actors at the time, but also for us today. And that was one of the things that sort of that struck us with studying this period in December 1941. And as you say, with the way in which the world has gone in the last couple of years, the knock-on effects, the way in which questions of things like Lend-Lease, which were important at this point, we're seeing very similar questions today. The US again emerging as sort of an arsenal of democracy, debates over whether the US should embroil itself in conflicts in Europe and in Asia. Where does the emphasis go? These were the same sort of debates that were going on in 1941. And this sort of, again, a clash of ideologies, sort of authoritarian revisionist powers against sort of the status quo powers. These are echoes of the importance of learning from those things. And one of the other things which I just wanted to sort of to finish on is with regard to ideology. We've talked in particular about the way in which I've been presenting sort of the way in which Adolf Hitler chose to go to war with the United States, and there was an element of rationality in the sense of seeing the US as sort of being involved already in this conflict, but at the same time, it was also part of an ideology that was sort of laced through with a paranoid conspiratorial anti-Semitism that saw the sort of Jewish world conspiracy, as he saw it, being centered in Washington and the importance of that. And so conspiratorial thinking, these again are huge echoes of the present day.
Yeah.
And from a diplomatic history perspective, the ability to be able to sort of really sort of drill down into what are rational considerations with regard to sort of diplomatic decisions, but then also the irrational and the way in which that motivates policymakers is a fundamental historical question and a fundamental dilemma of our present day. And I think diplomatic history, when done well, can allow us to tap into that.
Yeah, and sadly all too resonant. Serious history for serious times. Charlie Lederman, thank you. This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation.